from Relay FM. This is Downstream, a podcast about the present and future of streaming media. This is episode number 67, recorded April the 18th, 2023. I am your master of ceremonies, Jason Snell. And with me, as always, our director of strategy, Julia Alexander. Julia, hi, how are you doing?
Hey, Jason, good. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Spring, you know,
yeah.
Puts me in a good mood. It's a good
move. Have you cleaned yet? Have you done your spring cleaning?
I've done some of that. I have. Have you?
I had the best time of my life when Kevin has been away, and so I did a 6-hour deep clean on Sunday.
Oh, nice!
And I'm like thriving. Every time I walk into my apartment, I'm like, oh, it's so great.
I haven't gotten the power washer out yet. That's the next step. But we did clean out the garage the other week, and I work in the garage, so that's really major quality of life for me.
It changes your entire life. You just feel better, right? You feel lighter.
Yeah, to get rid of the clutter. It's all the stuff that just kind of collects. I wanted to, before we get started, send out a link. We'll put it in the show notes as well. You are on Just Dropped, the latest episode of Decoder, talking about a lot of stuff that will be familiar to our audience. If you don't know Decoder, it's Nilay Patel and The Verge. Nilay, one of my favorites. You used to work at The Verge. I have been, you know, interacting with Nilay at Apple events and things like that for years. I think he thinks of me as the go-to person for like the history of Apple, which is like, I'm still working, man. But I sense his presence where he nudges people at The Verge and says, have Jason write an article about that. But anyway, he's one of my favorites, and you're one of my favorites, and you guys did a podcast that people can listen to right now. It just came out. Yay.
Yeah. He probably remains my favorite boss of all time. And he is now somebody I text about football with. And, my favorite thing about this podcast, which I had a lot of fun recording with him, and it's always an honor to be on Decoder, but he introduces me as like the head of strategy at Parrot, which is great, puck contributor, great. And then he goes, and the most important part, a former Verge reporter.
Yes.
And I think that's just him to
that's
a T,
sweet.
Where he's like, this is my little family. And people go away and then they come back. It's
I love
great.
It. I love yeah. it. All right. We have kind of a mega topic this week. I ended up putting kind of everything together. Because I felt like this was I started making the show notes and I'm like, you know, these are all kind of connected because it's like streamer endgame. Like where it feels like there's been a lot of, talk about like, maybe things are starting to shape up in terms of where streaming goes from here in terms of some of the many streamers that launched over the last few years kind of falling back to reality. So I want to talk about Peacock and Paramount Plus and Max sort of, and we can do them in succession, or what we usually do is, you know, get them all mixed up together because that happens too. But you wrote a piece, and you wrote pieces about a couple of these, and then there's some other stuff in here too from your colleagues at Puck. But like Peacock, you wrote a piece about what's the end game for Peacock, and I thought we would start there. It's like the question is the end goal here to find a partner for NBC Universal, not necessarily to merge the big companies, because it sounds like that's going to be harder to do, but to form a more appealing streamer by pooling the content from a couple of these companies together. I don't want to say that sounds familiar. It sounds like Hulu or Spulu, but it is a little bit like, you know, would Peacock be more appealing if it was also Paramount Plus, let's say. So what do you think about where Peacock, I mean, also footnote, the Olympics this summer, right? So Peacock's going to do great this summer. It's going to do great. The question is, long term, is it going to do great on its own or does it need some help? So where do you think Peacock stands?
Before I give my thought, my favorite downstream thing to do, ask Jason. Two things. One's fun. One is more just of curiosity to me. First one, I'll ask both at once. First one, would you prefer summer or winter Olympics? And two, how often, if you use it, do you use Peacock?
Summer Olympics.
Interesting.
I know.
I'm a winter person.
I mean, I like the Winter Olympics too, but like there's so many summer sports, and so you got your basketball. Sometimes there's baseball. You got there's various track and field things. Swimming is interesting. I mean, winter's got its appeal too. Speed skating is the most banana sport ever, but there's also a lot of like, and downhill skiing's okay, but like there's a lot of, like, you know, biathlon, and there's a lot of things. And I should say I play a Winter Olympic sport at a non-Olympic level because I'm a curler. So I should say the Winter Olympics. I'm going to say the Winter Olympics because of curling. That's what I have to say.
I can't believe Jason was listing sports in the Winter Olympics and didn't use the one, or maybe you said it and I just missed it, didn't use the one where they go and they shoot every
biathlon.
20 feet or whatever. That's the greatest sport in the world. I don't even know why it exists, but it's fantastic.
Oh, well, I mean, this is hilarious that we're off on this tangent, but the reason the biathlon is interesting is because you have to do cross-country skiing and then you have to stop and shoot at a target. And the whole idea there is they get your heart rate way high and then you have to hold steady. And it's like, that's impossible. Oh. How do you do that? And so that's the shooting is sort of like how you got to be in the best cardio shape in order to hold steady to shoot a target. And if you can't hold steady, then you get time penalty. Basically, you have to go in laps. And anyway, I know more about biathlon. That's why I changed to winter. I like them both though. And this year, Peacock is gonna do live streams. They're really focused on doing live, and they've really embraced the idea that the network broadcast at the end of the day is highlights and human stories, and figuring that like if you want to watch the whole sport, you will just use Peacock. I assume they're going to put some of this stuff on the NBC family of cable channels as well. But like Peacock right. is the idea here. So I don't know. Last time I used Peacock, I used Peacock primarily for soccer. Mm-hmm. Also when there's shows on Peacock that from time to time that I will choose to watch. But mostly I think it's for soccer at this point. So I'm one of those people for whom the live sports play, which is a part of, when we talk about the future of Peacock, we just mentioned the Olympics, right? And when we talk about the future of them potentially merging with another service, I think a lot of the conversation is not just about the catalog. It's about the sports rights. I think that's because we're a sports corner focused kind of sports corner is always with us, Julia. Anyway.
I mean, yeah, of course. But here's my thing about Peacock, because I think you are the average Peacock user. And that's why I was so excited. I think the average Peacock person is in one of two buckets. I think the first bucket is I like a insert sport here, right? And Peacock has insert sport here. Typically it's soccer. It could be the wild card game, right? Or football. Like they have something. And so you go and watch a game there. The other bucket is like the prolific Bravo fan, right, who is watching a lot of next day programming on Peacock because Bravo has it's the type of network that has inspired collective fandoms across multiple shows.
Yeah, good branding.
And so what Peacock has done really well, and this is what I was trying to get to with the Puck piece, is created a strong learning lesson, I think, for a lot of these other big streamers. And that's important because, to your point, Jason, I don't know if Peacock exists long term in its current state as a standalone streamer within this one specific parent company. And a big part of that is there is a level of investment required, even if it burns you out a little bit on the financial side, in order to kind of really increase that mass adoption from the beginning. So this is why you saw Disney Plus price particularly low. It's why you saw Netflix price low when they kind of came out, and then they kind of increased their prices as their subscriber base grew. And now they're figuring out, like on Disney, the profitability side. Netflix is figuring out its next steps. With Peacock, what's been really interesting about this platform is that it has steadily increased its subscribers, right? If you look over the last few years, it's like actually doubled its subscribers in a short amount of time. But that still is only about 31 million domestically at the time that we're recording this. And I say that because it's earnings season and Comcast earnings are coming up. And so I'm sure that it will not be 31 million in a few weeks. And they're monetizing that at kind of an average revenue per user, about $10, right? So it sounds impressive, except when you look at the financials of Peacock, this company is sitting at still around $850 million in losses on Peacock, right? And so to put that in comparison, HBO Max is, or just Max now, is profitable, slightly profitable based on its adjusted EBITDA. If you look at Disney Plus, at the time that we're recording this, I think it was sitting at maybe like $150 million losses. I'm sure that will, or I'm not sure, but it seems likely it will swing to profitability either this quarter or next quarter for sure. And if you look at Netflix, right, obviously very profitable, $7, $8 billion in free cash flow. And so for Peacock, it's like there's this huge loss sitting on it. They're not necessarily investing in the platform compared to others. You actually have Mike Cavanaugh, who's the head of NBC Universal, saying, we actually don't view streaming as its own kind of division. We view media. And so we're really focusing on our media ventures. And this is really important because this sets up Peacock for a place of we don't really know where you sit in the streaming world, but the consumer behavior that they've really managed to tie into and to really build is a key lesson for anyone building out a significant streaming service. And the way I like to think about it, and I've talked about this on the podcast before, is that a lot of these streamers are large ecosystems that exist in our mind, and when you can see it in our vernacular, as channels. Right. So we say, I watch this on Peacock, I watch this on Max, the way we used to say, I watch this on ABC, I watch this on Sci-Fi. And that network means really prioritizing that increased engagement and finding ways to link all of this non-distinct programming into one distinct feeling. And so Peacock has done a very good job by using what I like to call heart rate spikes. So that's that event programming to sit on top of that steady heartbeat. And so if you think about it, as I say in the piece, you had the NFL wildcard game. 30 days later, exactly 30 days later, Oppenheimer dropped. 30 days after Oppenheimer dropped, the Harry Potter movies came back. 30 days after the Harry Potter movies came back, I think they had another large sport. Oh, they had WrestleMania. All right, so WrestleMania happens. So there's enough events that make someone who signed up to the platform, let's say for the NFL wildcard game, to go, it's interesting, I'll stick around. Like, there's just enough right before I have to cancel, because most people, there are some people for sure, I work with many of these people, who are like, okay, I watch this, I'm going to cancel it immediately so I don't forget to cancel. But the vast majority of consumers likely are like, I'm going to get the full value out of the sign up. If I'm paying $10, I'm going to get the full 30 days. And so what Comcast is hoping is by that point, there's another event to keep you. And what they've done a spectacular job doing is working to figure out what that audience cluster is, and then say, we have all this programming that typically you're getting on Netflix or you're getting on Hulu because we license it out, but it's actually right here. So we're using that event to draw you in, and we're creating this channel experience with all this other different distinct programming to say, and we know what you're interested in, and we're going to try to keep you here. So they've done a remarkable job of spacing out in terms of timeline. But what's equally important, as I pointed out in the piece, is they haven't done this at the sacrifice of other divisions. So if you look at Universal Pictures, right? Universal Pictures movies, they go to theaters, then they go to digital or rental or Blu-ray. Then they actually go to Peacock for 4 months before they go to Amazon for 10 months and then come back to Peacock. The animated films go to theaters, then they go to digital, then they go to Peacock as well as Netflix, and then they come back to Peacock. And the bet that Peacock is making, or that NBC Universal is making, is that there is a specific time period in which to grasp that audience who's interested in theatrical, and then that audience no longer cares. And so if that movie goes and makes money on Netflix now for the company, for NBC Universal, great, because it comes back, and within that period of time, we're going to have another movie that comes in its place. We're going to have a sporting event. We're going to have a show. And so they've managed to say the rest of the company we're not touching, compared to someone like Disney, for example, who said a few years ago, these movies are going to go to theaters, then they'll go to digital, then they're going to come directly to Disney Plus, where they're going to stay the entire time. So they've cut out a lot of the profit windows that have existed for in the pay one, pay two. So that's where you license out to other networks for a period of time. And so Peacock has managed to captivate on that event programming, create a steady heartbeat of inventory that people are now drawn to without sacrificing the other verticals. And I think that is going to be an increasingly important lesson for the players who are willing to kind of continue spending and do want to make streaming their priority.
Okay. So should I bring in Paramount now?
Bring in Paramount.
Okay. The story here, and I want to say that some of your colleagues at Puck have done amazing work covering this story that continues, right? There was this vibe out there that there is a deal because there was a 30-day exclusive negotiation period between Sherry Redstone and David Ellison. However, it's way more complicated than that because of the way that National Amusements, which is the company that controls Paramount, is structured. There are two ways you can buy Paramount. You can buy National Amusements, or you could buy Paramount, but National Amusements decides who buys Paramount, and then it gets really complicated because there are legal issues about how you properly, and I'm not a lawyer, but I'm just based on all I've read a lot of these stories now. basically, there are some rules about making deals that benefit you and not your shareholders that can become, once you open it to a transaction, you have to take a fair, you have to take the best deal. You can't take a bad deal that benefits you as the controller, but disadvantages the shareholders, is a shorthand version of that. So it's actually unclear whether it will be Ellison or a different group of people who have also made, which is Apollo, who have also made an offer, are going to buy Paramount. But one of the scenarios here is that if Ellison takes control of Paramount, they've said, Skydance, et cetera, has said they want to keep Paramount Plus. But it's also, a lot of people look at that business and say, I'm not sure there's a business here. Oh, Jeff Zucker's involved, by the way. Jeff Zucker might come back and run CBS. That's a wild part of this story that also broke. And Jeff Schell, my name doppelganger, who was out at NBC a while ago, it may run the whole thing if the first deal, the Ellison deal, comes through. So he's been biding his time and waiting. So I don't think we can leave aside the question of sort of like, where Paramount is going, because it's like a big question, and I'm interested in what you think about the possibilities there. But I also want to throw this in, because the thing I hear about the most, honestly, is that Peacock and Paramount Plus might be good partners. But there's also Max, right? But like, Peacock and Paramount Plus seem to be the most distressed, in a way, streamers, even though, you know, you've totaled up the Peacock assets. They do seem to be kind of peas in a pod, and they start with P, so that makes sense. Paramount Peacock, peas in a pod.
Wow, there's the episode title. Yep. Here's my thing. I think it's a really interesting merger, meaning not just the companies, but the merging of products. I think it's interesting from a sports standpoint. I think that becomes a really strong NFL player that which controls a significant portion of the domestic audience.
Yeah.
I think from a catalog perspective, obviously there's a lot of beloved entertainment there. But the issue with Peacock and Paramount has always been there's not enough investment on the original side to really make it a differentiated product. And the sports are interesting, but things are likely going to change over the next decade with NBA rights, with NHL rights, with the whenever the NFL rights are again, 11, 12 years from now. And Apple, Amazon, Google become players, Netflix, Disney are strong players. And the issue I've always had with Peacock and Paramount Plus is that scaling for the sake of scaling never works. And I think, you know, honestly, players like CBS, which is the largest asset underneath Paramount, even NBC, right, large asset under NBC Universal, they make better sellers of content than trying to be owned and operated distributors. And the biggest question I have with Peacock and Paramount is the international play. If we think about the future of streaming, right, like the vast majority of the revenue and subscriber growth is going to come from international markets. I said this on the podcast with Neil. Like, the domestic market remains your largest churn reduction effort, right? It is basically like it's a significant average revenue per user market. It is a wealthy market. And so if you can reduce churn and remain at a pretty high saturation point of 80 to 95 million subscribers, it's a really strong revenue intake. But in terms of what the size of that market is compared to the size of international as a whole, so not just different parts of Europe or Latin America, but as a whole, it's significantly smaller. And Disney has a strategy for international, right? Like, Netflix very clearly has a strategy for international. Amazon has a strategy for international. Apple is a global product, a global company, as Jason knows better than anyone. And so there's a pathway for a lot of these companies if they want to be in that game to then say, we're going to be a global player in different ways, right? I think Netflix versus Disney is a difference in strategy of how they operate globally, but they both want to be global. Peacock and Paramount Plus, like, neither have really expressed interest in global. Like, they're in certain international markets, but they're not really investing in it. In fact, they combined efforts internationally with Sky Showtime in certain parts of the European markets, including like the Nordics and the Baltics. And like that, like, it's doing fine, but it's nothing huge. And does that dilute like the Peacock and Paramount brand? Like, and there's all these questions I have. I think merging them to get back to the Paramount Plus question, part of me is like, I don't think Paramount Plus should exist. I know that David Ellison, based on reporting from my colleagues, Matt Bellany and Bill Cohen, David Ellison from Skydance is really interested in keeping Paramount Plus. He sees it as an asset and potentially with the merger. I don't see the need for it, especially if you're not. And I think it can just be a great supplier of content. Now the issue with this, right, is that there's a limited window to get in on this.
Right.
So you can strike really good pay one deals for, let's say, 3 years, 4 years. You can strike strong licensing deals for like 5-6 years. But you really are only going to make 3x what you probably should be making over the next year, because everyone is going to want to become a seller. And if there's too much product on the market, well, now we run into simple demand and supply economics, right? If there's too much supply, then the cost of paying for a lot of this goes down. And so now you might, for what you might get for $5, you might get for 50 cents. And that's really concerning if your main goal is to be a seller and you're still paying off some of these debts. But I don't think that Paramount Plus has enough in it to keep going as a standalone. I don't think Peacock merging with it, or even Warner Brothers Discovery merging with it, makes any kind of a difference. Really, what makes more sense to me, and this is where I don't think a company like Paramount is interested, at least from what I can tell, is merging like a Paramount Plus with a Spotify, right? It is like, if you create an actual use case for someone to come into this much more regularly, and maybe you tack it on and that works. But until then, it's just a scale play that I don't think makes sense. But what's your thought?
Well, I think, I agree with you. It doesn't make sense. I do wonder about when you talk about, especially in the US, sports rights, there are some strengths there.
Right,
You'd essentially be creating, for all that talk of Spulu, you would be essentially creating an NBC-CBS sports stream combination. And part of me wonders if that's the end game for some of these companies, is a much more sports forward product, whether it's rolled into something else or not. I do think that, you're right. There is a level of content that you need to have if you're going to play in this game. I think that the advantage of Paramount having a partner is that they could both put into the pool and create a better stream of scripted. Plus, you could throw in stuff from your broadcast networks, scripted and reality. Plus, you've got your sports rights, and you could beef things up. Because I think part of the concern is just that Peacock alone and Paramount alone is not going to be able to rise to that level. But if you pool that stuff together, it's a more appealing product. I mean, you're going to not be able to charge the sum of the two. It's not a bundle. You're going to have to take a little bit of a hit there. But I also see your point. Like, part of me thinks that when Ellison says, I want to keep Paramount Plus, part of me thinks that that's the sort of thing you say when you're about to acquire a company. And keeping in mind that he's presumably doing his due diligence right now, you say that now, but when you look at the books and you're maybe your offer is accepted and you're in charge, then you change your story at that point, because you realize that it's not necessarily
I think you're right.
It is a fully operational content generation shop, and they could potentially okay, so I'm a Star Trek fan. A little side Star Trek news, right? They announced they're renewing Strange New Worlds, and they are canceling Lower Decks, their animated series, after 5 seasons. And several people pointed out 5 seasons today is actually pretty good. For animated can stretch in various ways. But I pointed out to people who are apoplectic about this, like, Paramount's having a hard time right now, folks. Like, they're tightening their belts. And part of me immediately thought, geez, Netflix or Disney would probably pay pretty well to have Star Trek, right? Not to own Star Trek, just to have a stream of Star Trek content on their service. And I think to myself, is that a better business to be in? And that's just Star Trek. There are other, obviously, many more Paramount properties, but just using that as a microcosm, because it's one I know pretty well. Like, is it more valuable on Paramount Plus?
Well, I mean, you can see this type of strategic thought in how they're still approaching global, right? So if you look at CBS and NBC, they still license out globally because it makes more sense than trying to be an operator and for those networks. And I think if you look at where the vast majority of demand for a lot of the content within these parent companies fall under, like, it is it's the networks, it's the broadcasters. And that makes sense to me. Now, what is quite lucrative, or not lucrative, I should say valuable, and where I think makes a lot of sense in maybe Ellison calls it a merger. I like what you said about, you know, he's trying to go into the sale and you say things when you're going into a sale. I think it's a great point.
Yeah.
But I think where there is an opportunity to merge something, which in my opinion is just selling, is the subscribers. Literally, like that, just the subscribers. And saying, hey, we're going to give you, we're going to sell you Paramount Plus Peacock because we think it's going to be, you know, a great asset to you. The first thing Donna Langley or Mike Cavanaugh or Kelly Campbell do is shut it down, right? Okay, we're going to take some of the content. And this is the big question. This came up with, by the way, Disney and Hulu. There was this huge question of, are you buying Hulu the product or are you buying Hulu the content, right? And there was a difference. Right. There was a huge, like, you're not getting the content, you're getting the product. So I can see a world in which Peacock's like, okay, well, we just got whatever it is, $8 billion, $9 billion from Disney, right? We got the money on that. We'll give you half of that for Paramount Plus, which we think it's worth. We just want the subscribers. We'll shut it. Yeah. We don't need the content. We can license that out. But now all of a sudden, we're 100 million product.
Presumably, they would take the existing content deals. There's probably some content deals that you would want to keep. For example, maintaining the CBS, especially the sports content, and adding that in to Peacock might be valuable. But, you know, you would agree presumably on a length of a deal for that to continue and then see what happens, right? But you wouldn't be like, you wouldn't own the content. You would basically pick up the existing content license for a term. And then at the end of it, you would, if it was a good business to stay in, you'd stay in it for both parties. Or if not, you go somewhere else. But you've also, at that point, you've transitioned over all those subscribers and given them a sense of the new platform and the value of it. And then you move forward. And I think that makes the most sense, because let's keep this in mind. I don't think anybody's plan is to sell Paramount nor to NBC Universal, nor would they buy it, nor think would regulators allow it. But the streamer, I mean, nobody's going to argue that streaming services are not a highly competitive area here. And if the, you know, it's really different to say, I'm going to sell my service and you're going to get all this content until the license expires. That's not the same as saying, oh, NBC Universal owns Star Trek now. It's like, no, you get the shows for a certain amount of time. But it also frees up Paramount to turn around and take the right fits to Netflix or Max or wherever. And I don't know, that makes sense to me. It's a sense of a merger, but not in the sense of two active partners. It's more like a handoff. I think that's a better scenario.
Yeah, I agree.
And if you're David Ellison, the last thing you want to do is say, oh, I'm just going to kill Paramount Plus, it has no value, when your plan is actually to do something like merge it or sell it.
No, at the very least, you sell like an aspect of it. There's no world in which he's like, all right, we're just going to shut it down.
Shut it down, boys.
Like, no, it's we're going to do something with it. I just don't think there's a word. I think people see him saying, oh, I think there's a future for Paramount Plus. It's super important and we can merge it with someone. And they read it as, we're going to keep it alive. I read it as, there's a really important future here to make me some additional money, and we're going to merge it with someone, and that's going to keep this idea of Paramount alive within this larger streaming service.
So, and I just want to throw out again, like the sports, CBS Sports especially, huge as a concept, and huge. I'll throw in, potentially you've got some news assets too, Jeff Zucker, you know, whatever, but like, and you've got the network. I also wouldn't put it past them to say, I keep coming back to Les Moonves. Okay, Les Moonves got kicked out of CBS for lots of good reasons. He behaved very badly. He was a very bad man. That said, strategically, I think he was kind of brilliant. So he funded development of his streaming service by selling the international rights. He was focused on the U.S. because he felt like that was the core part of the business, and that he could just use the value of the rest of the world to unlock his business in the U.S. Not a bad approach, honestly, thinking about it now, to take the money from, not try to establish Paramount Plus around the world like the current regime is trying to do, and instead say, no, we'll just license it everywhere else to Netflix and Amazon, and it's not going to be a problem. So, you know, Moonves did that. Moonves as a CBS-focused guy, and he launched CBS All Access, and I keep coming back to the fact that that's an asset that's different enough that you could potentially retrench and say, actually what we want to do is have a CBS product in the US. And that's where you get your football. And that's where you get your local stuff. And that's where you get Survivor. And that's where you get CBS News and 60 Minutes and all, and Stephen Colbert. And it's a product that's for the US or North America, depending on what the rights are. But basically for the US and is very much using the CBS brand, which still has some value, and is primarily a, you know, sports and CBS content kind of thing. I don't know. It's probably like I could see them keeping that as an island of like, well, but in the US, we're still going
to
do.
I would like to point out that what Jason, for some of those who might not remember this, what Jason is suggesting, which is not a bad idea.
CBS All Access, we could call it.
No, it's not even CBS All Access. It's TV Everywhere. Do you remember TV Everywhere? Which was like, you just have your network and an app, which, by the way, is like that's what's funny about talking about streaming, because so much of us are going back to like.
Yeah,
that was not necessarily a bad idea. Like with the foresight, in hindsight and what we've learned now, like, is there an opportunity to do that? I think, to your point, I think some of those more low-key entertainment shows probably work better as a license because they're worth quite a bit. But I do think like the sports side of the equation, like the CBS Sports, I think that is a strong merge with someone. And I think that's a strong merge with a Paramount or a WBD.
Also, let me throw out there, Paramount owns Pluto TV, which is a pretty solid fast channel, and I wonder sometimes if that is one of their ways forward. Is, well, CBS has ads, and CBS is very successful, so we put a lot of content on Pluto TV, and maybe we've got a tier above it, and that we keep, or maybe we don't, and we just are like, you can watch this stuff with ads, or you can go find it on Netflix or wherever, and then they move on. I think there are ways. So I guess what I'm saying is, when Ellison says, we want to keep Paramount Plus alive, I don't believe him, but I think that that maybe he's got some thoughts about a strategy, he and his people, right? Because it's also Jeff Shell talking to him, and maybe
and
Jeff
Larry,
Zucker talking
and
to
his
him.
Dad.
And his dad,
and
Larry
his
Ellison,
dad.
Talking to him, the money man, who was a good friend of Steve Jobs, and presumably still with Lorraine Powell Jobs. And of course, Steve had his Pixar and Disney ties there too. So there's even the tech titans have some entertainment industry links. But yeah, it feels like there is value inside of Paramount Plus, but maybe not the way it is now. And so maybe there is something
well,
new to be done.
Well, if David Ellison has thoughts on
Call
this,
us.
He can always email us and let us know.
Our fee is reasonable. Let's bring us in.
David, you let us know what your thoughts
consulting
are.
Consulting thoughts there. But yeah, I think he and his team have some ideas about it. But, you know, it just before we check in on Max, Paramount and Peacock, like, they're not failures, but they're not what they need to be one way or another. And it's like, it feels like we are on the precipice of a next act in this story where they're not going to be able to do business as usual. Something's going to give, and we'll see what it is. It probably, in large part, it depends on, as you mentioned, one is how much money is Disney going to give NBC Universal for Hulu? And two, who buys Paramount? And then where are they? But we'll see. You wrote another piece on Puck that is worth us throwing into the mix here, which is not quite an end game, but a it's been a year. You called it HBO Max earlier, which is really funny because it's been a year of Max and having David Zaslav's new conception of this. And it's funny because on one level, I think that the feeling now is that Zaz... there's a lot less enthusiasm about what he was trying to do now, that it seems to just be that he didn't really do everything to the business that he had said he would. And then it's kind of flagging. At the same time, based on some of his milestones, Max at least is, like you said, profitable in terms of the EBITDA calculation, right? So great, like on paper, profitable. But where is, you know, now that we're a year in, like, where is Max? Where is HBO within Max? And where does Zaz go from here?
Yeah, it's funny. So there's so many conversations about Max that, in my opinion, feel very cosmetic, right? And to an extent, I feel that way about that piece, which I liked, but not every piece can be winners. And I kind of feel this way, where there is a part of me that is... Here's what I think is the overarching issue facing HBO. and I've mentioned this to people at HBO. HBO used to be responsible for HBO, right? It sat within an ecosystem that made it a nice add-on.
Right.
And so you went to HBO for whatever it is. You're watching a movie.
It was a direct-to-consumer offering back in the day.
No, but the thing about HBO, but the thing about HBO and the way that we think about it is it sat within this ecosystem and you added it.
Yep.
And so you could go to HBO to watch whatever you're watching, Succession, whatever it is. But then once you were done with it, it was not responsible for the rest of your evening. You were able to go, I'm going to go watch ESPN, I'm going to watch Bravo, I'm going to go watch CBS. And it was all part of one ecosystem. I mentioned earlier in the show that we think of streaming services like channels. And so and that's just the way that we approach it because it's one unified system. And the issue with that is when you had HBO in the name and when you had HBO as this kind of like fundamental brand identity, HBO went from being responsible for 25 million people to 80 million people. And all of a sudden, HBO had to be more than it was. And to be more than it was without changing the structure of HBO, which is the smartest thing they did, they didn't necessarily change the structure of what made HBO HBO. It changed it from a destination to a wholesale event. And I think removing HBO from the name actually puts it back as to being a premium aspect of a larger ecosystem. And so now HBO gets to kind of just be what it's good at, which is being HBO. It's not responsible for the entire health of this platform. And I think that's an issue that Max has not figured out, which is they have all these distinct identities, right? They have HGTV, they've got HBO, they got Adult Swim, like they have all these identities, but it doesn't create a cohesive environment. And so anecdotally, this is just me, when I opened up Max, like I opened up the other day and I wanted to watch The Sympathizer and it was in the carousel. Great. I was like, awesome. I'm just going to watch this. When I'm done with it, there's not one part of that system that makes me feel like, oh, I want to scroll through it. It understands what I'm trying to do. There's not one part of it that feels like a unified channel experience. The way that Peacock, at half the audience, has done a very good job with doing. Of being like, you're done with this thing, and we kind of know who you are, and we're going to figure this out. We're going to have a decent UI setup. And then we've got the live aspect, or live, like they have the channels. Netflix has spent a ton of money on the tech side, right? So when you're done with it, the next options are pretty spot on. Disney Plus kind of operates as, in my opinion, a very event-driven service. And so you go in for a specific thing and then you're kind of done with it. And that's how it has been until the Hulu integration very recently. But Max is like in between all these things. Like Max isn't really good at being the steady heartbeat. It is decent at bringing you in for the event, but it's larger. Its scale is larger than just being an event product. And so it hasn't found a way to mingle anything. And I think putting HBO in the title really associated HBO with that kind of wavering, middling brand. Removing it from Max, I think the best thing it has done is it's made the responsibility of HBO, HBO again. It is there to attract the 30 to 40 million people who are really interested. And by people, I mean subscribers. And then on average, there's like 10 million people who maybe watch the shows across different types of genres. And so it's allowed to just be that again. And I think that is crucial if you're thinking that HBO is the premium reason that people sign up for this. And Max has a huge issue in front of it of, which is almost reflective, I think, in the strategy of the executives. It's they've done a great job of tearing down. Right. Like they've done a great job of cutting debt. It's really a remarkable job in cutting the amount of debt that they've cut in a short period of time. And they have to do that because they're sitting on so much of it and they've gotten a profitability. But now they have to prove they can build. And Zaslav is a strong builder, but he built within an ecosystem that rewarded more and more and more. He built cable channels and he built specific identities within those cable channels. And they didn't have to take on the responsibility of appealing to everyone in the pay TV bundle. They just had to appeal to enough of an audience who were willing to pay for that add-on. And now you have to find a way to turn all these different add-ons into a synonymous experience of an app that has an identity to it. There's a reason that people go to it for something over a different app. And I don't know if they can build that. And so I think that's kind of where, to end all this rambling, it's this really interesting position where I think like the Max issues are still very prevalent, but HBO being removed from the title 1 year later, I think has almost protected HBO in a way that it really needed. And there's no doubt in my mind HBO will be fine no matter what happens. It has repeatedly been fine when it changes ownership. But the Max question, similar to the Paramount Plus question and the Peacock question, is this big question mark still for me.
One of the contradictions of this era that we're living in is that branding and brands and cohesion matter in ways that they've always mattered. But the landscape, because you're not in a cable bundle or just flipping around a TV dial, is so complex that it's following, I would say, basically tech industry rules where you cannot have eight different players. It just doesn't work. And that contradicts the other, right? Because I think the right solution for HBO is to offer is what they used to do with HBO. Which one was that? Go, HBO. I forget. They had so many different versions of it where it's literally like, no, you just pay for HBO $9 a month and you get HBO and all of the content from HBO's library. And it's just standalone. But you can't do that in this era, right? I mean, you could be, if you're a niche player with a very niche market, you could maybe do that. But like, everything is trending toward these huge streamers. And so you're right. Like, in the end, I think the best hope is you become a very cohesive tile with strong branding inside a larger thing. And whether that's, you know, whether that's Max or whether it is the Hulu stuff inside Disney Plus, you just sort of that's the place. And I agree. I think HBO being untethered from having to be responsible for the content outside of its brand in the streaming service is good for HBO as a brand. Even though it's less visible, it's clearer. The challenge is going to be structurally how brands like HBO, and I would say, you know, I mentioned Hulu earlier, and honestly, FX is sort of the brand that powers a lot of my interest in Hulu. And it's, you know, but okay, so we'll call it Hulu then. But it really, I'm talking mostly about John Landgraf's stuff at FX and Casey Bloys at HBO. It's a similar kind of story.
Well, and here's the thing that's really interesting. I'm thinking about it, I think, for the first time now, which this podcast is very good at doing.
Yay.
And what's interesting about the Peacock situation, right, is that umbrella of content, for lack of a better term, flows exceptionally well, right? So something that I study a lot at Parrot is kind of this affinity, this overlap of content interest within different groups of people. And the Peacock offering works spectacularly well for the audience it worked with, because even if you're done watching football and they recommend Chicago Fire or they recommend one of their other new big broadcast shows, or they recommend a movie, like, there's, you can see the audience connection. I think when you look at Max, there's no audience connection, right? Like, the HBO audience is not necessarily interested in Discovery, and that was always a concern. But is the HBO audience interested in Adult Swim? Are they interested in DC, right? Like, you have all these great tiles, but there's no connective flow between it. And I think that's the part of the issue, is that if there's no connective flow, if there's no inherent, like, oh, I get this type of enjoyment out of this app, then there's really no reason to open that app beyond that event. And I think this is something that Disney is really trying to figure out. I think they've spent a lot of time really trying to figure this out on the recommendation side of, okay, we can put Hulu within Disney Plus, and that's great. That's a huge start. But what are the audiences looking for? The people are coming in for Star Wars. What are they interested in, right? Is it like this show? Is it this type of show? And then how do we really ensure that we're creating this experience of, I go here for any form of entertainment I'm looking for, not just this one thing, because that increases engagement, strong for ads, reduces churn, strong for price increases, and all the kind of baseline economics that define streaming. And I think that is a question that Peacock is actually the closest to figuring out, to bring it back to where we started, than Max is at this point, even if they have the larger audience.
Mm. Yeah, it's funny. I know this whole podcast is just all about recurring themes. But one of the things that I brought up even back in the TV Talk Machine days with Tim Goodman is that, you know, it was so much easier when you just had a channel you put things on, because you got good as a TV person at putting things on and knowing what people wanted to see, you know, to varying degrees. But like, it was all, the interface was the channel and you turned it on at home. And one of the things that I keep thinking about regarding modern television is, we've gotten really good at making TV shows. Like, there's whatever, 80 years of that now. And shows and peak TV, I know the number is coming down, but like your prestige TV shows look like movies. Your mid-budget TV shows look like movies. We've gotten so good at that part of it, the creative part of it. I think even on a reality side, on a live TV and sports side, the technology used, the techniques, the artistry is amazing. However, everything that we do is now mediated by software. It's mediated by an operating system that's running on a streamer box that may have been done at, you know, depending on what you bought, it was either like an overpriced, over-technologied Apple TV streamer box, which has its advantages, quad box, stuff like that, or it's on a lower-end box that was perfectly reasonable and cheap to buy, but is underpowered and maybe slow and maybe has a business model where they need to analyze your viewing patterns and stuff like that. That's not great. So the OS level is iffy one way or another. And then on top of that are the apps. And the apps can vary between platforms, which is not great, but also it's the cloud services behind the scenes that are doing the personalization and all of that kind of thing. And like, user interfaces for streaming are so important because they are not just help me pick up where I was watching. You did a story. We'll talk about this some more, but you did a tweet about how like, it's like, why do I want to go to watch show or watch episode or want to see more? And like the interfaces could be so much better. The recommendations for you could be so much better. And it continues to strike me. And maybe this is because I come from a computer side perspective, but it's like, it's amazing how many of these things they still get wrong after years now of working on this. And I have to think, and I know there are a lot of smart people who work on this stuff who know very well, but the challenge is it's complicated. They're still learning it. And I think at the executive and corporate culture level, there is not as much, if you're not Netflix anyway, and maybe Amazon, not as much attention to this as being important as there should be. Even now, I think that there are a lot of people in this business who are more focused on the content strategy and not appropriately focused on the presentation and interface strategy, which is desperately important. As you just literally said, Peacock is way better than Max at this thing. But like, the narrative isn't that Peacock is way better than Max, right? The narrative is, oh, Peacock, they're kind of troubled. But like, some of this stuff really matters and I think doesn't get the attention it deserves. Anyway, that's my rant about interfaces.
I agree too. I think the narrative definitely does not tell the story about Peacock being bigger or better than Max in any way. And quite literally, it's not bigger, and better is subjective. But I do think the overarching lesson and what we've been talking about in this section is really this idea of these legacy streaming companies that, legacy companies that have streamers. And so they have a lot to consider. And what I can really tell is that the NBC Universal, which had this broadcast and pay TV side, kind of figured out how to create strong connective networks. So networks that worked independently, as well as a strong connective ecosystem. And so figuring out, okay, we have this and this is how pay TV works, and without being on the supplier side. And now they're kind of taking those lessons and applying it to being on the distribution side. And I think that's where Max still really struggles, is it didn't, they were independent premium networks, right? They were cable networks. And so they just had to be a part of an existing structure and get people to buy into them. And so they made really strong programming for these individual networks, but these networks didn't necessarily have to flow cohesively in any way. Versus NBC Universal seemed to think of that a little bit more, even though it also didn't necessarily need to create networks that did, but they thought about that larger system. And I think you're seeing that play out in how the strategies are defining a lot of these user experiences on streaming. But no one is out yet, maybe other than Paramount Plus. Like, no one is necessarily out yet. And so there's a lot of time to learn still. And so it'll be interesting with the legacy companies as they continue moving forward.
All right, let's move on to some streaming advice from listeners. We got a lot of it. You can go to downstreamfeedback.com and send in yours if you've got advice for us and for the other downstream listeners. But I will throw in some that we've gotten. Adam wrote in to say, Criterion Channel. structuring their content like film festivals or DVDs with special features. It's a really accessible way to get into older movies, even though older can sometimes mean the late 90s. Oh, no. With their recent hacker movie collection. Great example of a niche streamer. I wish there were more, but I feel like in the long run that there will be niche streamers that will be successful because not everybody needs to be Disney Plus or Netflix, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So,
and the whole thing with niche streamers, remember, so like HBO,
yep.
HBO Now couldn't work in large part because the cost structure of running that, it was not a niche service. And so the churn rate was really high. But if you're running a niche, which makes any form of subscription product impossible to manage. But if you're running a niche service where you've got maybe 5, 6, 7 million subscribers tops and your cost can remain relatively low, and because that audience is seeking out a very specific thing that is interesting to them, Criterion Channel, Crunchyroll, whatever it might be, it can be very lucrative by operating at a kind of higher ARPU level with lower overall operation costs in a very specific market. So, yeah.
And
not everything has to be Disney Plus.
Right. And for the channels, there's good marketing potential because there are a lot of partners out there who will also resell your channel for you, resell your streamer. So it will get you into Amazon will resell it and Apple will resell it, right? Like they that is not a bad business. You don't have to just be out there on your own. You can also be an upgrade option inside some other service or operating system. So that's good too. Yeah. Criterion. I have not subscribed to that, but I have definitely thought about it. It's a great idea. Michael wrote in with some show suggestions, which is not quite the same, but Michael seems to be in Australia. So he says Colin from Accounts, which is on Paramount Plus, Rosehaven and Gold Diggers, which were from the ABC in Australia, don't seem to be available in the US at the moment. I will throw out related. I just finished watching Deadlock on Prime Video, which is an Australian TV show that I thought was really good. Some wild tone shifts, but it's basically if you remember Broadchurch, it's like, what if Broadchurch, but all of the sadness was replaced by jokes? weird tone, but it works. It's a good murder mystery that has lots of jokes and is funny. Yuvraj wrote in to say, Criterion Channel. Ah, there you go. I've been a subscriber since day one. It's the only streaming service that I haven't canceled and resubscribed to. What they lack in size of the library, they make up in quality. It's an excellent source of classics from many countries. And all the commentary tracks, right? Why aren't those on other streamers? Is a huge bonus. There is something to be said. Again, what is Criterion Channel? It's licensed content, right?
Yep.
But it's licensed with a purpose for an audience, with good curation and some extra content like commentary tracks that most streamers just don't care about. But that the Criterion Channel audience does care about. Like, that's a business. That is totally a business. Not a, like you said, it's not a huge scale business, but I think it's a business going forward. Criterion's
Agreed.
A great example. Curation, it matters. Finding your audience, finding your people who are willing to pay, it matters. Not everything is scale. As somebody who does small podcasts and has a small website with a small number of subscribers and I'm able and my costs are low because it's basically me and a few partners, like I get it. Not everything has to be scale for it to make sense. Andrew wrote in and said, Broadway HD is wonderful if you love the stage theater.
I love Broadway
musicals.
HD.
Great idea here. So, it's a channel inside Prime Video, or you can get it on like Apple TV. It's got its own app. Another really nice idea, right? If you like that kind of content, there's a streaming service that you can use that will give you that content in your house, which is such a great idea. Let's see. Mark wrote in and said, I finally remembered last month that through my Verizon plan, I get ESPN Plus as part of the Disney bundle. I hadn't used it at all. I discovered it has NHL hockey, which surprised me. But more important, I learned how many international sports it has. I started watching cricket on a whim, and now I'm kind of hooked. You can watch, there's like Gaelic football or something in there. There's some lacrosse. There's a lot of like, during basketball season, there's like Division 2 and 3 basketball in there, or Division 1, 2, the lower Division 1 and 2, the smaller leagues are in there. There's all sorts of stuff that's in ESPN Plus.
It's kind of wild to me because ESPN Plus is so good. It's kind of interesting to me that it hasn't been integrated slightly better into the other apps. I know there it is on Hulu to an extent, because I know I go to Hulu and it's like, watch this game on ESPN Plus because I have the bundle too. And so that's great. A lot of, to your point, Mark, a lot of hockey that I get because my house is a big hockey house. But I'm hoping that the Hulu aspect on Disney Plus means it might be a little bit easier with ESPN Plus. Mm-hmm. The only thing I consider is that maybe the tech stack is difficult to kind of navigate. And of course, ESPN OTT is coming out next year.
I think that's it, because I think the ESPN Plus is great content, but it is defined by what it lacks, which is all the ESPN content. And if you can put those two together, it's a great product.
Agreed.
Also, I like some of their originals are good. You know, Peyton Manning's Omaha Productions has put out like 5 different shows that are these cute sports documentaries. They're kind of reality. They're silly. They're fun.
He just, if you're a sports signed fan, an overall, right, with them. I think Omaha Productions just did an overall deal.
I think so. And they've got plans. They're talking about signing Bill Belichick. Apparently they're in negotiations with him.
I just Googled that's exactly what came up. Yeah,
it's pretty wild, right? But like Peyton Manning, because the idea there is that you get they do the Manning cast too, right? So the idea there is that you get Bill Belichick to talk about football somewhere, because he's in a scenario where he's willing to speak, and that would be really compelling. He's not going to talk about himself, but he might talk about like strategy in a game. So,
well, just to show you how valuable this clearly is. So they had, I'm just reading the ESPN press release on it. This is in 2021, there was an original 3-year agreement with Omaha Productions, right? Which led to the Peyton, like the Manning cast. And now this is now a new 9-year agreement. So, they tripled the agreement. I think that tells you exactly how well Disney thinks of the partnership.
Yeah. And the Peyton's places and Eli's places and all that are cute. And then they've got the Bannon cast, which I think is like going to be a template for, it's already a template for a lot of extra content. Because if you've got the sports rights, one thing you can do is make different versions of the sport simultaneously and let people choose for not a lot of added cost and a lot of added value if you do it right. It's kind of a brilliant move. I watch the Manning cast a lot. I
love the Manning cast. It's my favorite way to watch Monday Night Football.
Yeah, I don't love it when they have guests who are just like talking about their thing, because then it's like there's a podcast going on. But when it's just Peyton and Eli or a really locked in ex-player or current player who's talking about the strategy and the game, you know, and little behind the scenes and all that. Who do you think wins?
Because it's inevitable, right? The next Manning cast, obviously the Kelce brothers cast of some capacity. Sure. And it can't happen until Travis retires. When Travis retires, because Jason just retired, who do you think wins that deal?
Oh, that's interesting. Right now, I'd say Travis, because he's just so much higher profile.
No, but who do you think, network-wise? Do you think they go to Amazon and do like a Thursday Night Football?
Yeah, I mean, I think everything is open for that. But I do think we live in an era now where it's not just like, oh, would you like to be the third string color commentator on CBS?
Right.
And it's more like we are going to do a second stream with the Kelce brothers on Prime Video or something like that. Yeah. Prime is a good example because they've already, you know, that's a streaming product, but it could just as easily be that it's Peacock and it's an alternate to the Sunday Night Football, or that it's really any of them could do it. CBS could do that too, if they wanted to. But yeah, I mean, Prime, that's a good one. I think they're into experimentation. Really quickly, a couple more. Adam said, 2 streaming services we use extensively in film school that no one outside of our program seems to have heard of: Canopy and Criterion Channel. Again, Canopy's low awareness makes sense because it mostly targets college students, but it's also available through a library card. Yes, Adam, that's how I know about it. With the Criterion Collection's reputation, I'm surprised their streaming service is not more well-known considering its price-to-catalog ratio. So, Canopy, let's throw it in there. You probably have a streaming service that you get with your library card. You should look at your local library and ask them about it. And finally, Kyle says, Shogun on FX and Hulu and Disney Plus now. And he says Game of Thrones comparison, but they also say Succession was an influence. I'll just say that the 10th episode and final episode of Shogun comes out next week, and I can't wait. I love it. It is my favorite show going right at the moment. It is super good. So good job, FX. And good job, Justin Marks, who is the showrunner for that, who did Counterpart, which is one of my very favorite shows of the last decade. So,
you know what's so interesting about, okay, I've been thinking about this, about Shogun, because I got into it recently. Love it. Super, super good. And I just watched the first episode of The Sympathizer, which is on HBO,
right.
Which is based on the acclaimed novel. And I forgot the author's name. But what's interesting is like Shogun is half in Japanese, right? And they weave in and out. The Sympathizer is like half in Vietnamese and they go in and out. And I think there's this really interesting moment that because Shogun is doing very well. And so obviously like Squid Game was very big mm-hmm. for Netflix. And I think we're going to start seeing not all of these kind of foreign language shows popping off in the US, but I do think through some of these networks, you will start to see, especially if it's quality programming, of course, more than anything else, that adoption of more foreign language content in the US, like Gen Z tends to watch with more subtitles than anything else. They are increasingly used to consuming content from other regions that have other languages. And so as that starts to come into the US, I think like I look at Shogun and I look at The Sympathizer and I look at Squid Game and I'm like, oh, there's a moment now where you might be able to see a lot more of this type of foreign language content finding an audience in the US, especially amongst younger audiences. I don't think that means that they're all going to go invest in like a Japanese or Vietnamese content, but I do think they're starting these companies like Netflix, Amazon, Max, Disney are starting to think a little bit more like if we're going to be a global service and we have to invest in local content and we want to find ways to bridge that gap a little bit, get two bites of the same apple, these types of shows really usher in an adoptability and an adaptability for US audiences. And that will be an easier selling point. Not that that would be the goal for local content. The goal of local content is to have local audiences. Right. But if you can kind of create these types of waves using different languages and kind of getting that global acclaim, it's a nice, really excellent additional win. So it's been fun to watch those two shows play out with each other.
Shogun is interesting because Shogun is an FX production. So right. it was written in English and then translated, and they have a playwright do it, and it's apparently all above board, and the support in Japan has been positive. But it's essentially an international, it's not a co-production, but it's an international production. It was intended to be for an international audience, and some stuff that imports well was, you know, built for one audience and just finds a global audience. But there's something to be said for going into something like Shogun and saying, yeah, it's mostly going to be in Japanese, but that's okay because this is a show we believe has a global audience, and we're going to bring it to everybody, and it's going to be in the US and it's going to be in Japan, and it's going to be the rest of the world too. And that's, I love the ambition of that. I will point out that they hedged. There is a dub that you can watch. It's we're talking about Criterion and not having commentary tracks and things like that. There is a dub that is not at the audio track level. It is at the menu level of Shogun, where you can flip over to English dub if you can't do subtitles. And that's fine. I haven't watched it. I can't even imagine watching it. But you're right. I think my daughter leaves captions on all the time. So I feel like, and she's 22. So the younger audience, I think, is very comfortable with captions and they don't care. All right. Before we go, one letter. This is from Jamie. He writes, in the UK, there's currently an advert for Disney Plus, something along the lines of, think you know Disney Plus? You only know half the story, and highlights adult targeted content like Pam and Tommy, Shogun, Poor Things, Kardashians, The Bear, and the Aliens franchise. Is this a global campaign following the Hulu-fied rebranding? As it doesn't make a huge amount of sense to me, as they've advertised that content for years being on Disney Plus, unless they've failed previously to ship the perception of Disney Plus.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know the exact reason. I imagine, to your point, Jamie, that there's definitely an aspect of we are doing this campaign for Hulu integrating into Disney Plus. This is similar to what we do with Star already internationally. We can roll out a global campaign as opposed to just a domestic one. Another one might be just furthering that idea that this is all now part of Disney. But it was funny. I was speaking to Neilai, I guess, about this on the podcast. I was like, who's I talking about this on his podcast? And this idea of like the Disney brand recognition is a fun one because Disney has changed its brand multiple times. Like the idea of what Disney is, like Disney started 100 years ago as an animation studio. And by the late 90s, early 2000s, it was a cable company, not as an operator, but it was like a television company, right? And there was theme parks in between that. And by the time you got to 2019, it was like a franchise theatrical powerhouse that was allowed to exist in part because of the success of ESPN. And now it's like an entertainment tech company. Right. And so what I think, but this goes back to this kind of through line of our conversation Jason and I have been having throughout the day, throughout this episode, which is you have to figure out a way to be an all-encompassing channel for everyone. And like that is how you become a strong scale streamer. And so what Disney needs people to, or what Disney needs audiences to kind of wrap their head around, is that I go to Disney Plus for my Star Wars, my Marvel, sure, but I also go for The Bear and I go for Kardashians and I go for next day programming, right? And like I go for all these other things that are if inherently and effectively part of Disney's new brand. And that will be a big part of Disney's brand going forward, right? And so it can't just be Star Wars, which you can do maybe two shows a year and a film a year. And that's great. Like those are really strong, that those elevated to heart moments I was talking about, like those moments of like, this is really exciting and I'm going to go into this. But the strategy for streaming services is that it's much more in line with television than film, right? And so television is a steady heartbeat. Film is like big spikes. Television is steady heartbeat. And Hulu really provides that steady heartbeat on Disney Plus. And so finding ways to reiterate this idea of like, this programming that is not necessarily Disney in terms of it's not Cinderella, it's not Nemo, it's not Star Wars, but is part of our brand going forward, they've got to really get that message out again and again to the point that, I mean, think about it. Star Wars 15 years ago was not Disney, right? And like now it's a core Disney brand. And so they just need to get people used to that idea, and not just used to that idea, but then thinking about, okay, for no matter what type of entertainment I want, I'm going to go to Disney Plus because it has the Hulu integration. It'll eventually have domestically the ESPN OTT integration. Like whatever I want out of TV, I can get from Disney Plus because of all these reasons. And they have to market that out, especially because when Disney Plus launched just 5 years ago, it'll be five in November, the idea was you came here for Star Wars and Pixar and Marvel, and now it's no longer you. I mean, you're still coming here for that, absolutely. But now it's a big part of, okay, but what do I do with the other 95% of my time? Remember, right, the core question facing entertainment companies that has changed drastically over the last 25 years. It used to be you sat on your couch and you said, what do I want to watch? And now you sit on your couch and you say, what am I going to do? And that change in attention fighting is hugely worrisome for all entertainment companies, because now they have to figure out how to exist alongside Fortnite and like TikTok and everything and podcasting and everything else. And finding a way to be an all-encompassing app for someone who's going to spend their portion of their doing time watching something, which is a smaller portion of their doing time than it was 25 years ago, is really getting that message out that you can get the vast majority of what you want from this one app and spend time with us. So Disney has to. They have to market out that this is now a part of the Disney experience. This is what you get within the Disney Plus bundle. And soon will be kind of, you know, the Disney Plus experience. And so in my read, that's what it is. It's just that continued persistence in getting that message across.
Right. I mean, in the US, there's an impetus for it, which is this idea that now Hulu is integrated. And so that content is in the Disney Plus app and they want you to sign up for the bundle, which is a good deal. Like if you care about that content, it's a good deal to pay for the bundle. And they really, I think, want the Disney Plus Hulu bundle to be seen as the primary option. But I'm sure they had that conversation where they said, rest of world, at least in key markets, rest of world, we could probably stand to remind them that this content is that you might not attach to the Disney brand as part of the Disney Plus service. So I think it's doing it, the impetus was probably the Hulu thing in the US, Jamie. But I think that they said, well, if we there's value in doing this elsewhere too. We can still remind people.
Yeah.
All right. Listeners, if you've got your questions, comments, streaming recommendations, downstreamfeedback.com. Love to your mothers. We love hearing from you. And you can consider subscribing to Downstream Plus. This is a full-sized episode for everyone, but every other episode, the only way to hear the complete version is to subscribe. Go to downstream.plus to support the show. You can find our director of strategy, Julia, at parrotanalytics.com and puck.news. You can find me at sixcolors.com, and I appear on many other podcasts at RelayFM and theincomparable.com. Until next time, Julia, say goodbye.
Bye, guys.